Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
My name is Beth. I'm an alcoholic. Because of the grace of God and the steps and fellowship of AA and sponsorship, I've been sober since June 26, 1988. I do bring a clock with me just to, give you hope. I used to just watch the clock, but then I would forget what time I started, so it didn't do any good, so now I have a stopwatch. However, it also flashes sports scores through, and I'm a little on the ADD side, so if I stop in the middle, the Reds are playing or something, and I'll be back if I leave. I want to thank the committee for inviting me. This is a huge honor. This is a huge convention. My sponsor is Peg M. from Bellevue, Nebraska, and she talked about when she was speaking somewhere in California and there were 5,000 people there and she was freaking out and she was thinking to herself, that's 10,000 eyeballs looking at me. What am I going to say? So I've been kind of thinking about that all week, except that that's 14,000 eyeballs looking at me. And then, of course, some of you know what happened to her that reminded her that God was in charge and she was just there to tell her story. And that's kind of how my day went. I took a nap and I timed everything perfectly so that I could get up because I was going to come hear Clancy do Singleness of Purpose. From there, we were going directly to dinner and then straight here for the meeting. So we were timed down to the split second. So I get up to get ready. And I flushed the toilet and it flushed, as it should, but it made kind of a weird noise and I thought, huh. And, so like an idiot, I flushed it again. The water was clean, thank you God, but it started to rise and then it kept rising and now it's flowing over the bowl. And Chuck's still napping and I'm thinking, well, I can deal with this. It's okay. So I threw the bath mat down. Well, it is still coming. Now it starts to pump. You can hear the pump, and it's pumping out, and it's pumping out, and it's rising. The water is rising in the bathroom, and when it got up to the carpet level, it starts to come out and it's still pumping water out. And I'm thinking, I have to get ready to go hear Clancy talk. And I'm in there trying, I'm standing in 2 inches of water in the bathroom, clean water, I hope, thank God. And I'm starting to get ready, so I go to pick up the hair dryer, and I thought, no, probably not a good idea. May have to go without curling my hair today. And it wouldn't stop, and it had to be 5 or 8 minutes. We finally called maintenance, and we're like, we need some towels and a maintenance guy and more towels. And so when he finally comes, the water has finally stopped, but it is all the way out the carpet, all the way to the wall, like the width of it, And so he shows up with a bucket and a plunger. And I just said, I don't think the plunger's going to do it. So he looked and he said, I'll go get housekeeping and we'll move you to another room. I'm not particularly superstitious. I have returned to church in sobriety, but I'm not fanatical. However, I need to let you know that they moved us to room 666. And I just thought, okay, somebody has a sense of humor. I'm not sure if it's God. And then I remembered Peggy talking, and for those who haven't heard Peggy's story, while she's sitting there freaking out about 10,000 eyeballs, she felt something wet hit her dress, and a seagull had crapped on her dress, huge, big, berries in it, just gross, and she had to go speak, and she just took it as a sign from God that she just was some broad from Nebraska who was supposed to tell her story and that he was in charge. And so by the time we were in, you know, I was no longer standing in 2 inches of water trying to dry my hair, and we had moved into room 666. I just went, okay, God, like, you are in charge. I give up, because my, you know, my schedule is not working. So I'm very happy to be here tonight. But it's probably good that I put the hair dryer back down. So anyway, I'm sure Clancy did a great job on singleness of purpose, because he always does. And dinner was great. And it's just great to be here. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I never thought I would say I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I tried so hard to not come to Alcoholics Anonymous. When I got here, you'll hear if you're new, if you make a list of what you want, you'll sell yourself short. And I heard that and I thought, whatever, you know. But really, all I wanted when I got here was, I wanted my driver's license back. You know, I wanted to not get arrested anymore. I didn't really want to stop drinking, but I did want to stop going to jail. And I thought that maybe someday I would like to remarry, preferably this time to a guy that had a job. But I never remembered to ask that at last call. I don't know about you, but that's where I did most of my dating. So I should have had a list. I just never remembered to ask little things like, are you married? You know, do you have a job? But I was at AA meetings at a very early age. My father joined Alcoholics Anonymous in 1966. I was 7 years old. I'm 55 now, so you don't have to try to figure that out, because I know some of you are out there counting, because I'm a counter. So I'm seven. My dad's in AA, and they don't have a lot of money. So I grew up in Oxford, Ohio. That was my first resentment. I did not want to be from Ohio. I didn't want to grow up in Ohio. I thought Ohio was uncool. I don't know why. I had nothing to compare it to. I just knew. You know how you just know? Is that Larcine that says information comes out of nowhere, lands here, becomes fact? That was my thing with Ohio. I just knew it was lame. And I remember being the first day of first grade and seeing a map of the United States and seeing California. I was born in California. I was supposed to be a California girl, but I was moved against my will to Ohio at age two. So I'm in first grade looking at this map of the United States and seeing California and the Pacific Ocean and the Gulf and Texas and just all these wonderful places. And then looking at Ohio and thinking to myself that you could look at a map and tell that nothing is happening in Ohio. And it took me a long time, because I thought, where does that come from at 6 years old? You know what I mean? It's like, because really, I grew up in Oxford, Ohio, and it was a great place to grow up. It was a college town. I was going to college sports at 6 years old. The town was small. It was safe. We could, you know, kids could walk the streets at 6 and 7 years old and go to football games and go to basketball games. And that's where I got my love of sports and it was a wonderful place. But what I know now is already at 6 years old, I was restless, irritable, and discontent. And already at 6 years old, I was looking for something on the outside to make the inside feel better, because I just never felt quite right. One of my favorite promises in the Big Book is the one that says we can be alone at perfect peace and ease, because I absolutely could not before I got sober. If I was alone in a room, I was in bad company. I had a whole chorus of voices in my head, and none of them liked me. You're thinking it was my head. I could, you know, train one to say something nice, but they all told me things like, nobody likes you. You know, they just play with you because their mom makes them, and, you know, they're all talking about you when you're not there. And then when I got here and they talked about being self-centered, I didn't really get that. Because I'm not one of those people who walked in the doors and said, oh, thank God I'm home. I want what you have, and stayed forever. That wasn't my experience. I went through treatment, at least 3 times. Rumor has it a 4th time. I don't remember. I kept saying, no, I didn't. And I finally realized that the guy who was telling me was 28 years sober and I wasn't, so he probably knew. But who wants their parents' solution? My dad was in AA. I had been to AA meetings. It was all old men who ate donuts and drank coffee and smoked. I'd seen it myself, you know, because I would go to open meetings as a 6 and 7 year old and be back in the color, you know, coloring book in the corner while they had their meeting. And it was really anonymous back then because they smoked inside. So once you got up to the table high, you couldn't see anybody, you know, and things. So I don't really remember my dad's drinking, you know. I didn't grow up in untreated alcoholism. I didn't grow up with yelling and screaming. I grew up with parents who went back to college as I got older, and the older I got, the more our standard of living improved. I, of course, never got everything I wanted because, well, who would? But and I had a long list. But, you know, I had everything I needed. And by 6 years old, I'm looking for outside things to fix an inside problem because I don't belong where I am. And I don't know what to do about it. I just thought if I lived here, I would be happy. If I had a brother, I would be happy. If my mom didn't work, or maybe if she dressed more like Susie's mom, or if this or if that, and it was all based on anything on the outside that could change how I felt on the inside. Because at 6 years old, you just don't know to go, I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. I should probably go to AA. You know, who knew? My dad probably knew, but he, you know. And so I always had one good friend at a time. Don't talk to my friend because she might like you better. And then I'll have to get another friend and, you know, and you guys will talk about me and you'll tell your friends and they'll tell their friends and they'll tell their, you remember that Brett commercial, you know, and she told her friends and she told her friends. And so then you walk in and everybody looks and everybody laughs. And again, I didn't really get that self-centered thing when I got here. I came through AA and they said we were selfish and vain. And I thought that selfish meant, you know, I took the biggest piece of pie for me. And self-centered, I don't know what I thought it was, but I knew it wasn't me. And it took me a while to learn here that self-centered for me looks like if I can't win, I don't want to play. And self-centered is, you know, I didn't know self-centered meant that you will never, ever, ever see me try anything new in public. Because I might fail and you would see me fail and that's unacceptable because I can't look bad. And self-centered for me looks like if I walk in a room and two people lean their heads together, I know they're talking about me. And so I, you know, self-centered was, I was a spectator in my own life. It was like there was a camera up here watching everybody else watch me. And I was keenly aware of everybody around me and if they were looking at me and if they weren't and if they were laughing and all of that, and I was a spectator in my own life. I remember the first time I actually had a whole, a conversation with somebody where, because Peggy says, you know, really alcoholics don't have conversations, it's just two people talking, and that's true a lot. And I remember when I realized that I was actually having a conversation with somebody, and I was 3, 4, 5 months sober, and I realized, you know, they were talking, and I was actually listening. Cause usually if I ask you how you were doing, it's hurry up cause I really want to tell you what I'm doing. You know, I didn't really mean how are you. You're supposed to say fine, how are you? So I can tell you. And, so my husband had told me at one point that I was had a type AL personality and, and I had to ask what that was. He's an MSW, so, you know, he's knows his way around a few diagnoses. And so I said, well, what is a type AL personality? And he said, well, I have no doubt that you're a type A personality, but you're lazy enough that you're not annoying. And it's true, really. I used to say I was a 50-mile dash girl in a 5-mile world. You know, I'm a great starter, but the finishing part I'm just not so good at. But truth be told, really, if I could set a lawn chair up at the start line and just let you bring me the trophy, I would be fine with that. When I got sober, my children were 4 and 6, and they were not in my custody. But my daughter, Sarah, she was a 4-year-old. Robbie was 6. And we're watching Sarah thinking, oh my, we're in for it. You know, I mean, she had the gleam in her eye. She had radar. There were 2 kids she talked about at school all the time. And when I finally went to a kind of a PTA thing where all the parents were there, because they lived in this neighborhood with my mom. Now, I was a biker, and my mom lived in the suburbs. Like, the whole neighborhood stepped off the pages of an L.L. Bean catalog, you know, and then there was me in my leather jacket at the parents' meetings. And I walk in and I see 2 sets of parents leaning on the wall in the back of the room. Everyone else is seated except these 2 sets of parents. Well, guess whose parents they were? Sarah's 2 friends. And I thought, it's like they have radar. How do they know? You know, so we're watching her. I mean, Chuck and I used to tell people, you might be saving for college. We're saving for treatment. And, and then she took this weird turn on us at 11 years old. She wanted to be on a swim team, and I know a lot of you have heard this story, but it really illustrated to me how off, because the big book says that drinking's a symptom, that drinking is not our problem. You know, if drinking was my problem, not drinking would be the answer, and I'd be fine. But when I don't drink, my life becomes so unbearable that I have to drink again. That's why when she started to read the long form of the traditions, I kind of got excited because, you know, tradition 3, not that they make mistakes when they write things, but just my opinion here. But, you know, tradition 3 in the long form says we think AA ought to include all who suffer from alcoholism. And I think that's very different than having a desire to stop drinking. Just my opinion. But anyway, so I'm suffering from alcoholism because when I don't drink, my life gets worse. So Sarah wants to be on a swim team, and she's 11, so I'm 7 years sober. And we take her to try out for the team because a lot of her friends were on it. And the coach said, well, I think you'll be all right. You don't have much experience in the water, but we'll go ahead and put you on the team. But I want you to practice down an age group because I don't think you could keep up with your age group yet. Now she's 11. And in swimming, they swim in groups of 2 years, you know, there's 11, 12, and 9, 10, 8. And so this means at 11 years old, he wants her to practice with 9-year-olds, okay? 9-year-olds, and she's 11. And it was okay with her. I was 7 years sober. And it was barely okay with me. I mean, you know, if you ask me, where's your daughter, and I have to tell you, how am I going to look? You know, yeah, mine's the 11-year-old swimming with the 9-year-olds over there. So, so she's only had 2 weeks of practice at the first meet, and these are USS teams, so they're 25 teams, and they run heats, and they post the results with everybody. I mean, anybody walking by can see how you did because they put everybody's name up. And her very first race ever, she was 70th out of 72. And she went back on the next day. I would have been trying to get my parents to relocate. You know, I mean, that would have been the end of my swimming career. And we told her, well, Sarah, you know, you didn't win. But now you have a baseline time. And in your next race, even if you don't win that race, if you beat your time, that's still a successful race. Now, the whole time I was telling her that, I'm thinking, oh, yeah, right. You know, I mean, God, just please get a ribbon. Please get a ribbon, you know. But I knew that's what you're supposed to tell your kids to build yourself. My parents told me that when I swam. I never bought into it. I knew they had to tell me that. But Sarah beat her time, and she was happy. The rest of that story is 2 years later, Sarah was a state AA swimmer. She swam all over the Midwest. And what I realized was that she had somehow grasped that concept of set a goal, work for the goal, achieve the goal. I'm sure they tried to teach me that one. As I said, I would rather sit at the starting line and just wait for the prize. But she got that, and she worked for it, and she accomplished things, and she, you know, it was amazing. And when she started swimming, if they had told me that very first day to practice with the 9-year-olds, I could not have gotten in the water. I wouldn't have done it. I mean, that would have been the beginning and end of my swimming career that first day. And at 11 years old, I had never had a drink, and neither had she. And it made me realize how completely differently we reacted to life. And I since really think that she doesn't react to life. She responds to life, and there's a difference. You know, I'm a reactor. I'm like the ping pong ball or the pinball, you know. I'll just go here till I hit some, and then I'll go this way till I hit some, and I'll go this way till I hit some. And Sarah just does what's in front of her. And so we started watching her with interest after this swimming thing, you know, because we weren't real sure what to do with her. You know, we had our treatment fund, and so she started doing things like she got a summer job and she saved money. And she went through 12 years of high school in 12 years. She had the same friends when she graduated that she had in first grade. I had to, my first geographic cure was I went to public school in seventh grade from a private school, because I thought if you'd been in school with the same 26 people for 6 years, you would hate them all too. But, you know, she was fine. So same friends 12 years later. She decided at the end of her freshman year, during career day, you know, they came and talked careers, and she determined during her freshman year of high school that she thought maybe when she graduated, she would like to join the military. And 3 years later, when she graduated, she joined the military and served 10 years in active duty. So we're very proud of her. That included 2 tours in Iraq and one in Afghanistan. And and she had a daughter somewhere in there 2 years after she got married. I mean, what do you do with a kid like that? You know, when she was 14, we said, you know, there's supposed to be one mature person in the house. We think it might be you. We just... Another one with a bright future in AA laid out ahead of her at age 5, and she just threw it all away. But she, the Afghanistan deployment was the one, you know, that was the third deployment. She had a 4-year-old, and she decided to not reenlist. You know, her date was going to come up a couple months after she got back from Afghanistan. So she and her husband made the decision to move to North Carolina, and so our son-in-law and our granddaughter moved to North Carolina while she was deployed, and when she got back to Texas, she had 3 months to go there, and then she came to North Carolina, and now they live, you know, like less than 20 miles from us, which is just what a blessing, you know. The big book says families will be reunited, and I never dreamed, because they were not in my custody. I wasn't really even allowed to take them anywhere with me when I got sober, because I found someone who thought that we should go to Florida, and it seemed like I'd wanted to move south ever since I found out it was warmer other places. And a friend of mine, I tried college. That didn't work. I guess it goes better if you go to class. But I couldn't go to class because I don't know how to talk to people. I do not know what to say after my name's Beth. I'm just blank. Because everybody is arguing about what we should say next. And I'll meet you and I'll say, hi, my name's Beth. And she'll say, hi, my name's Linda. And everybody's arguing about what do you say? Well, she's from Minnesota. You could talk, but you like the Reds. Well, what if she doesn't like baseball anyway? And, you know, and so they're arguing and I'm paralyzed. We just have to go. And, So I couldn't go to class because, you know, you have to talk to people in class. That's why I greet a lot, by the way, still. To this day, conversation is not my best thing, but I've learned in AA, if you don't know how to talk to people, be a greeter. If you're new, just park yourself at the door because you give the appearance of talking to people as they walk by to get coffee, but there's no real danger of conversation. And it'll keep you there till the meeting starts, and then by the time the meeting's over, you feel better. So I greet. But I college didn't work, and I thought I'd disgrace my parents. I went back to Ohio briefly. I tried working in a bank. That's respectable because everybody's watching. You know, banks work Monday mornings. That was a fast career. And then I had a friend who had a friend in Florida, and he said we should go, and I said we should. And took off, ran away from home. At that point in time, women were disappearing at a rather rapid rate from Ohio and in the Midwest. So I kind of left signs that I had left voluntarily, but I didn't tell them where I was going or anything. And we took off to Bonita Springs, Florida, and which back then was two traffic lights and a dog track and three bars, which really limits the dating pool. And I got a job in a convenience store because I'd worked in one in Ohio. So 2 weeks later, when I called my mom to tell her where I was, you know, I'm like, don't worry, though, I'm assistant manager at this store. And she's asked me, you know, well, Beth, why didn't you just tell us that you were moving? And I thought that was kind of a dumb question since I'd run away from home. You know, you don't usually announce it when you're going to run away from home. And she said, you know, honey, you're 19. You could have just moved. And I, what? You know, I had no idea. I was a 19-year-old runaway. And, I just never investigated things very well. And so now I get this job in this convenience store. Well, it's so transient down there that if you go to work 3 days in a row, you're management material. So by the time I call mom, I'm assistant manager at this store. And she says, she asked me this one question a lot. She would say, how can you do something that's stupid and land on your feet? It just made her crazy because I did all the time. I was like that guy in the cartoons that the pianos and the safes are just falling behind them, you know, and I would get clipped every now and then, but I just never got crushed like I should. The only time I ever got suspended from school, it snowed and there was no school the next day, so there's no suspension on my record. I mean, that stuff happened to me all the time, and I think on some level I just depended on it. So now I'm in Florida, and there's no checks on my drinking. By the way, I should mention I loved to drink. Morning drinking, why wouldn't you? My day just went better. The earlier I could start, the better my day went. And, plus in high school, then you could sober up before your parents get home from work. And in Florida, you know, it's 80 degrees by 6 o'clock in the morning, so hey, let's get a beer. And but it was a very small town, like I said, with only three bars, and by the end of 8 months, I was out of places to work and out of places to live, and it was looking like I was going to have to move back to Ohio, which would have been violating one of my two rules that I live by. One was never, ever, 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 ever admit that you have made a mistake, you know, and the other is it's not all right not to know. Don't ask a question because then they'll know that you don't know. And so I'm getting ready to have to move back to Ohio because I'm out of places to stay. I'm out of people to date. As luck would have it, a guy moved to town from California. And I had a friend who said they really should put a state line or a sign on the state line of California, Arizona, and Florida that says this state doesn't work either. And if you saw somebody pull up, read it, just slump and turn around and leave, that's the alcoholic. But they didn't have a sign, so he came too, and it was, you know, that was violating rule number two, never admit you made a mistake, because we were together 5 years. I used to say there never should have been a second date, really, but there wasn't. He had a keg party, and I just never left. I needed a place to stay. So I stayed, and we got married. We had a couple kids, and we spent some time in the Keys, which I think sped my trip to AA along quite nicely. There were There are a lot of other things floating around in the Keys. I'm a child of the 70s. I heard in treatment the term drug of choice got thrown around a lot. And, really my favorite was yours, whatever you. You got it. I like it. And, but when I got here, I didn't struggle with where I belonged. It was very clear to me that I was an alcoholic. My story is I was 29 and a half when I got sober. And by the time I was 24 and 25, drugs were starting to interfere with my drinking. And I just quit doing drugs, because anything that interferes with my drinking has to go. It has to go. I put the drugs down because they were interfering with my drinking. And by the time I was done, all those other things I put down included my integrity, my word was worth nothing. My children were gone because they were between me and a drink. I left them alone to drink. They were in bed. I had nothing to drink. I didn't know I had to drink. I just thought I wanted a drink. There was a bar down on the corner. I figured I'd walk down, get a drink, walk back. They'd never know. They were asleep. They were 1 and 3. My 3-year-old son woke up, couldn't find me. Came outside on the front porch, and it was a step down out of the front door, so he couldn't reach the door to get back in. And he stood on the porch and cried, thank God. Thank God he didn't just go try to find me, because I probably wouldn't have known he was gone until the next morning. Grace of God. A neighbor heard him cry. They called the police. The police didn't really have to try hard to figure out where I was, because my car was parked right in front, and there's a bar down the street. So they called the bar and asked, they suggested I come home, and I didn't really want to, but it seemed like a good idea. And I go home, and they say, is there anybody we can call to come take the kids? And I'm thinking, well, not my mother, for God's sakes. I'll never hear the end of that. And so I said, no, I guess thinking they would go, well, okay, well, see you later. So I said, no. And they said, well, then we'll have to call 241 kids. And I said, oh, wait, my mother lives here. And so my mom got that call in the middle of the night that no mom wants to get. Come get your grandchildren because we're arresting your daughter for child endangerment. And my mom at 51 years old had to get up out of bed at 1 o'clock in the morning and come pick up a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old. And she became their primary caregiver. I went to treatment because it was suggested because child endangerment was 6 months. And it was suggested if I went to treatment, I might not have to go to jail. So that seemed like a good plan. And I found one treatment center that took you without insurance, because by now I was already unemployed. And God's cosmic joke on me, it was all women, and it was 6 weeks long. Because, when I came around AA, when I would pass through, they would always say, hang out with the women. And I just would think, I didn't even drink with women. I mean, in high school, when the girls drink, they fall down, they throw up. It's so embarrassing. They giggle. They everybody likes the same boy. They wear pink, for God's sakes. And then later, there's husbands, and it gets very confusing. And it was just easier to drink with the guys. And so, I was never real excited when I would come to AA and they say, hang out with the women. And now I'm in an all-female treatment center. Oh, goody. And but I had a big book when I got there, because while I lived in the Keys, I had one minor incident at work, and they fired me. I thought they overreacted a little, but, And so I went to an AA meeting in the Keys, a Tuesday night Key Largo group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they were very nice. They were old. I mean, I know these people had to be 40, 50 years old, and I'm 24, and the meeting was over at 9, and they invited me to Perkins, and I'm thinking, Perkins, okay, let's see, it's, I'm 24, I have my own Harley parked down the street, it's 9:30 at night, and I've been invited to Perkins. Should I kill myself now, or have pancakes first? And But, crash goes another piano. I went back to the general manager of the hotel where I worked, told him I knew I had a problem. I'd been to an AA meeting. I, you know, I got my job back after one AA meeting. AA works, it really does. And I called my dad and I told him I had been to an AA meeting because I would go visit with him every now and then, you know, and he would always take me to a meeting. I thought it was nice. He wanted me to meet his friends. It didn't occur to me. He was going like, please God, let her hear something, you know, but I called him and told him I'd been to a meeting because that's the first time I ever stood up and said I was an alcoholic. I never, ever said the A word in the same sentence with my name. Because if you have a sober parent, you know, I've heard people talk and they say they would sit in the bar and say, oh, I'm alcoholic, who cares? Well, if you have a sober parent, that's just a luxury you don't have, you know? I knew if I ever said alcoholic and Beth in the same sentence, that a big book was going to drop out of the sky, you know? The bartender was going to hand me a meeting schedule and the AA police were going to carry me out of there. So I might need to slow down a little or not mix those again, but I was never wondering if I was an alcoholic. But at this meeting, I actually said I was an alcoholic, and I felt an odd sense of relief when I did that. And I called my dad, and I told him I'd been to the meeting, and within a week, I got a box from him. 12 and 12, big book, hardcover. By the way, if you're new, get a hardcover, no paperbacks. You just can't throw away a hardcover book, can you? There's some about it. So hardcover, big book. Each day a new beginning, 24 hours a day, one day at a time. A few pamphlets, a cassette tape of his talk. I don't know how long he'd been putting it all in the box, but one meeting and it was in the mail. So fast forward 2 years later, now I'm in Ohio because I finally got divorced. I'd wanted divorce really since before I got married, but I'm not crying, Uncle, because then it would be my fault, you know. So finally he said, get out, and he only had to say it once. I'd been waiting for 3 years. He said, get out, so I called Mom. Like, he threw me out, and I wanted to relocate in Florida, but she was not in a big hurry to send me money. I'd also had one other little incident down there that involved some it's expensive to live in the Keys, you know, and I made pretty decent money at the hotel, but we had a small home-based part-time business. And just a part-time job, and because there's a lot of importing and exporting down there, and so we just kind of had a local distributorship. And I didn't want to be a kingpin. I just wanted a couple hundred extra bucks a week and some free product. That's all I was after. And we got arrested for that. So, you know, crash goes another piano because, again, somebody screwed something up. I walked away with probation on that, and they really thought it was all his fault, and I didn't really correct them, even though he wasn't really smart enough to run a business, but I wasn't going to tell him that. But because of that, Mom was not sending me any money to relocate in Florida. I got plane tickets to Cincinnati. So back I go to Ohio in 1984. And I thought, okay, fine, you know, maybe I should try AA, maybe. But I thought if I just quit drinking with bikers that things would calm down, you know? So I tried drinking in her neighborhood, which stepped off the pages of the L.L. Bean catalog, and that, you know, of course, didn't work either. So I go to AA in Cincinnati, and I gotta tell you, in 1984, Cincinnati Young People's was on fire. Icky Paw had been in Cincinnati in 1983. And in 1984, the Monday Night Young People's meeting had 200 people. And the Friday Night Live meeting was 150. And it was active, enthusiastic, structured, sponsored Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it was. However, when I walk into a big group of people, it tends to split into two groups, all of you and me. And it was clear that you all knew each other and you were all talking about this stupid book. And, you know, nobody really remembered my name. I don't know if I gave you my name really because who wants to be new, you know, and you should remember. And I'm sure I gave it a good 2 weeks. I'm just sure of it, but it didn't take. Now, I was getting there a minute before the meeting started and out the door the second it was over so I could go drink Coke at the bar with my good friends while we played pool. But I just couldn't do it. And so, you know, various trips through treatment and this women's treatment center I went through, I was the one that they came to get to talk to women who didn't want to leave their children for 6 weeks. Because I'm a test taker. You know, if you're a test taker, you know who you are. You can read anything, spit it back on a test the next day, get the A and not know what you read 2 days later. And you can ace treatment if you're a test taker. I was always most likely to stay sober forever, you know. But I'm in this treatment center with all these women, and they would get me to come talk to the women to talk to them about leaving their children for 6 weeks, because if we, you know, 6 weeks now or forever later, because if we're not sober, we can't be parents. But I had a rapidly developing problem, and the big book calls it a double life, the one that we know is true and the one we want the world to see. And what I was realizing while I was in there, as I, you know, as the alcohol left my system, and my mind cleared, was that I really didn't want my children back. And that's just not the kind of thing that you tell people. You know, for somebody who doesn't like to look bad, that's not something that I'm going to bring up in dinner conversation. But the thing is, I knew at my mom's they were being cared for. They were in a blue ribbon school district. They got breakfast at breakfast time. They got to daycare on time in clean clothes. They got dinner at dinner time. They got a bath every night. They slept in clean sheets, and she read them a story every night before they went to bed, every single night. And I couldn't do any of that. And I was not gracious about her doing it. I made her life miserable at every turn. I can tell you, you know, because alcoholism doesn't care. Alcoholism wants what it wants. And I blamed everything on her, you know, and I can tell you in one sentence the kind of daughter I am with untreated alcoholism. I would periodically have the kids for a weekend, and, you know, it would go okay. And about 4 o'clock on Sunday afternoon, I might mention that I was thinking about getting an apartment so we could live together soon, and they would get all excited, and I knew I wasn't going to get an apartment, but I knew they would go home excited and tell Grandma, and she would have to talk them down and be the bad guy. You know, and I did that on purpose. How do you make amends for that? You know, and that's the kind of stuff I'm doing while I'm seeing butt out. I'm not hurting you. I'm not hurting anybody but me, because that's what we say. I am not hurting anybody but me. While the entire family is nothing but scorched earth around us, I am just hurting me butt out of my life, you know, and thank God she went to Al-Anon because she, you know, it made a big difference later. So I was in and out of treatment, you know, a few more times, and I finally ran away from home one more time at age 29, back to Florida, because I thought everybody was thinking, God, you know, it's been 4 years. I wish Beth had come back. And things weren't going very well in Ohio anyway. So I got a one-way ticket. Mom had a credit card she let me carry in case of emergency, and going to Florida that day just seemed like an emergency. So I went, one-way ticket, never coming back, and get down to the Keys, and of course nobody's really excited to see me. I'd forgotten about that arrest and the probation and all that, and I ended up on Sunday, June 26th in the Fort Myers airport, and the credit card was tired. It wouldn't take a plane to get back, and I'm also extremely lucky that back then a high limit on a credit card was $3,000, or else I would be in prison for a very long time. Because now they're, you know, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 American Express bill cards, but thank God she didn't have one of those. And I called her and I told her where I was and what I'd done, because I didn't even have a dollar. You know, I couldn't get a beer. I didn't have enough for one drink, and I was so hungover, and I knew I looked so bad that if I walked in the bar, it would be obvious I was looking for somebody to buy me a drink. And even as bad as I felt, my ego would not permit me to risk getting asked to leave the bar, because we don't want your kind here. And I thought about, you know, nobody had ATM cards back then. And I thought, well, maybe I can just grab a purse from a little old lady and get a little cash and get a drink. But I just was so hungover. And I just knew that I would pick on the little old lady that still did aerobics twice a week. And she would, she'd run me down and take her purse back and I would look very bad. So I called Mommy, because that's what we do, and told her what I'd done, and she said, call me later, and hung up. And then when I called back 2 hours later, she'd been talking to those Al-Anon people. which is good. It's good. And she said, I want you to know I booked a plane ticket for the children's mother. It's not really for you because we're afraid we'll never see you again if we don't. And I got on the plane and I hadn't had a drink all day because I didn't have a dollar. And if I'd known that was going to be my sobriety date, I'm sure I would have tried to get a drink on the plane at least, but she didn't buy me a first-class ticket, so I couldn't drink on the plane. And so Sunday, June 26, 1988, is the first day I didn't have a drink, and I did not have a clue that was going to be my sobriety date. She picked me up at the airport, and she drove me to the local detox, and she dropped me off at 1 o'clock in the morning and said, go in or don't, but you cannot come home with me. I've done everything I can do for you. You have to do it yourself. And that's what she got from Al-Anon, and thank God she did. Because if I'd gone home with her, I would have had time to back up and regroup, you know. And as soon as we got Plan B, we are good to go. And so I spent 7 days in detox, and the first day I'm laying there kind of pondering my situation and trying to figure out, you know, come up with Plan B. And I realized that everything I had tried had failed. I had no Plan B left. There was just no friendly direction at all. And I realized I wasn't going to die. You know, I realized I was 29 and a half years old, and I just never thought I'd be 30. I never expected to be 30, so I didn't have any plans to be 30 because I wasn't going to be there, so why make those plans? And I realized I was 29 and a half, and there was nothing wrong with me. Well, chronic alcoholism, but other than that, nothing. And I realized I wasn't going to die. You know, if they had told me, Beth, if you walk out of here and get a beer, you'll be dead in 6 months, make no mistake, I would have left and got the beer. But one of the reasons I never attempted suicide is I knew on some level that I would live. I knew I wouldn't die, and I'd probably, you know, be one of those, I'd be maimed and look bad and, you know, can't do that. And I'm laying in bed trying to figure out what to do, and it's like this voice came out of nowhere and just said, people like you don't die, Beth. And I just thought, and I knew it was true. And I knew that I was going to live 30 or 40 or 50 more years, whether I drank or not. And I couldn't bear the thought of another 30 or 40 or 50 years the way I was going. Because I knew, no matter how bad it was right then, I knew it would get worse. Not could, would. I knew that. And I knew there were levels of worse that I knew about, and that there were levels beyond that that I had never seen. And at that point in time, I still had, you know, all my fingers and toes and no real visible scars. And some of the stuff that happens to women, you know, that's horrible had not happened to me yet, but I knew it could. And we're in Minnesota, so I can tell you a southern thing. When I moved to North Carolina, somebody told me how you boil a frog. Now, I never thought I was going to have to know this, but I'm going to tell you in case you ever need to know. So if you put a frog in hot water, he will jump out. You know, makes sense to me. But if you put him in cold water and turn up the heat a little bit, he will adjust. And then you can turn up the heat a little more and he will adjust. And you turn the heat up a little more and he will adjust. And suddenly he's in boiling water and he never knows what hits him. Now, is that not alcoholism? Is that not what happens to us? You know, it gets worse and we adjust. And it gets worse and we adjust. And it gets worse and we adjust. And every now and then we're almost ready to do something about it, but we rally a little. And then it's like, oh, thank God, I almost went to AA, talk about overcorrecting. You know, God. Whew! You know, and then it's bad again. And every time we rally, we never rally back to where we started. You know, we just rally a little higher than we were. And I knew that day I wasn't going to die, and that scared me to death. And I just had this passing thought that whatever those people in AA are doing seems to be working for them, and what you are doing clearly is not working for you. Maybe you should just go do what they do. And I didn't know that was like the surrender, you know. I mean, I was a biker, for God's sakes. I thought I'd go down in flames, you know, but it was just this one pitiful little voice that just went, screw it. And they had a 30-day program at the detox center that I, you know, seemed like a good idea, but they wouldn't let me go through, and I was pretty insulted by that. I mean, you would think they would want me to succeed. And the guy said to me, Beth, you know everything that we're going to tell you. You already have all of the information you need to stay sober. Why don't you go do it and leave the bed for somebody who doesn't have the information? Well, I mean, if you're going to put it that way, you know. What do you say to that, you know? And again, thank God, because if I'd had 30 days, I would have had plan B by the time I got out, you know. If you are new, I hope you are out of plans, you know, I do. I hope you are. I always wish desperation to new people, because if we're not desperate, we don't do this stuff if we're not desperate, you know. That's why in early sobriety, I was hearing somebody's four step, and she had done the resentment part, but she hadn't done the other two, the sex and inventory, and she wanted to go ahead and do the resentments, and I was said, okay, fine. And I later realized why I would never do that again. And it's because she felt so much better after she unloaded the resentments that the desperation was gone and she never felt the need to do the rest, you know. I had to be desperate, you know, we have to be desperate to do things, you know. Like they say, we hang out with people we don't like doing stuff we don't want to do that we don't think will work. But, you know, I mean, what else are we going to do? The book says that we can go on to the bitter end, you know, or accept spiritual help. And you know, I have been known to say, well, you know, what kind of bitter end exactly are we? You know, I mean, you know, quick death, slow, painful death, what? And I have found that normal people don't have to make, you know, they don't have to stop and think about that. except spiritual help, okay. So when I got out of detox, it was Friday of 4th of July weekend. My car was impounded. I remembered that was why going to Florida suddenly seemed like such a good idea. And I couldn't, I'd made arrangements to go into a hotel for women. That should have been a sign of surrender right there. And I couldn't do anything until Tuesday, because it was 4th of July weekend, and I got out of detox on Friday, July 1st. So I scraped up enough money. I knew if I went where I lived, I would drink. I knew that. And I scraped up enough money to get a hotel room, and I used the hotel is a very loose term for this place, but they did have rooms, and they did take money for them. And it was right on the bus line because my car was impounded. So I just had to walk out the door and get on the bus and ride it down Reading Road and walk one block. And I was at 405 Oak Street in Cincinnati, which was the AA clubhouse. And that's what I did. And the first night I almost didn't go, because I've been going to meetings all week. I could take a night off, you know, but one voice in my head said, you know, you skipped meetings before and you drank. Maybe you should just go. So I got on the bus and I went. And the girl that was speaking that night was 4 years sober. I had met her when I was passing through 4 years before. And she told an entire room full of people, because Friday night at Oak Street was a couple hundred people. She told that whole room full of people that alcoholism, not drinking, alcoholism had taken her to the point where she didn't want to work and she didn't want to take care of her daughter. She just wanted to drink. And that was my biggest secret. And she just told a room full of people. And I got her phone number, you know, and I stayed for the midnight meeting. Thank God they had a midnight meeting, because I was a bar drinker. And if I'd had to go home at 9:30 or 10, I don't know what I would have done. But I stayed for the midnight meeting, and then I hung out and found somebody to give me a ride back to the hotel so I wouldn't have to ride the bus, you know, at 1 o'clock in the morning. And the next day, I just went back down to Oak Street again. And I just, you know, and I went ahead and bought another big book, even though I had several, multiple copies from my multiple trips through treatment. But they were all in Norwood where I lived, and I knew I'd drink if I went to Norwood. So I bought another big book, and I just, this hotel had a pool and no bar. That seemed like a good, you know, a good combination. But they were, so I'm on one end clinging to my big book. Thank God it didn't rain that weekend. And I'm reading my big book on one end, and the other end, all the employees have coolers of beer and they're down there smoking dope. And then I got my big book, and then I would get on the bus and go to another meeting. And the second night I'm already feeling a little better. And I don't know about you, but you know, the first thing I get back when I start feeling a little better is my opinion. So I'm sizing up how to not look new, because who wants to be new? And I knew if you sit in the back, we know you're new. But if you sit in the front, you're in great danger of having to talk to somebody. So I picked the perfect seat in the second row. And there was a, this place was an old house, so I took the seat against the wall. So at worst, I was going to have to talk to one person. I thought I could probably deal with that maybe. And, so speaker spoke, meeting's over, time to say the Lord's Prayer, and I got a wall here. I have no hand to hold. What a loser. Can't even say the Lord's Prayer right. You know, I just thought, God, you know, really? The whole committee is in session again. I stuck my thumb, you know, in my pocket, hung my head. Say the prayer alone because I don't have a hand to hold. And somebody in the front row turned around and took my hand. And to this day, I don't know who it was, but I got to tell you that that one action is the reason that I came back on Sunday. Not having a hand to hold Saturday night was going to be enough to send me back out the door because I knew everybody would see that, you know, she doesn't have a hand to hold. Nobody likes her, fill in the blank. And whoever that person was, and I've never found out, they're the reason I came back on Sunday. And I got to tell you, that is 12-step work, too. Sometimes we start talking about 12-step work, like sponsoring a bunch of people and going out and, you know, pouring out their alcohol and whatever. But you know what? Remembering a new person's name is 12-step work. God, I just wanted you to know who I was. But I didn't even know that's what I wanted, so how could I ask? You know, I thought I didn't care. I thought I didn't care. I don't care if you like me. Why aren't you talking to me? I don't need you. I don't like you. Why aren't you talking to me? Help me. So I came back the next day because somebody held my hand that night. You know, that's the only reason. And the next day, the meeting was at 7:30 and the clubhouse closed at 10 and there was no midnight meeting and I didn't know what I was going to do because the bars don't close at 10. And right before the meeting, some woman walked by, grabbed my hand, said, "Don't leave after the meeting. We're going to the movies." She didn't say, "Do you want to go?" She didn't say, "Do you have any money?" She just said, "Don't leave. We're going." And, as it turned out, we went to see Roger Rabbit, which as you know is about 8.5 hours long. So. It got me through till the bar closed. I had such a good time. I called my mom when I got back to the hotel room, you know, and just told her that I had been to the movie. I guess I'd laughed. I'd had a good time. I know she panicked when the phone rang at one. One of the greatest gifts I gave my mom, she told me at a year sober, was that when the phone rang, she no longer had to wonder if that was the call that said I was dead or that I had killed someone else, you know. I mean, that's what I put her through while I was not hurting anybody but me. She was afraid to answer her phone. She was afraid to answer her door because she never knew what she would find. And I just started going to meetings. I went to Big Book meeting every day at noon because I knew you should read your Big Book every day, and I figured that would count. And they read a whole chapter at a time, so this is good, you know. And because it chews up half of the hour, so there's less chance of having to share. I didn't really think about the fact that they wouldn't call on me with my 4 days of experience, strength, and hope. But you know how we are. And God's got a great sense of humor. You know, I have a friend who calls AA God's perfect ballet, and I love that. You know, because what happened was I'm in this new meeting every day. Oh, and the other thing was, you know, hey, my day's free at 1, so I got all day to do what I want. But at 4 o'clock, I'd remember I had no life. So by 6 o'clock, I'm back there for the 8:30 meeting because I knew if I went, you know, to where I was living and turned on the TV, I wouldn't leave again. So I just went straight to Oak Street at 6, and I stayed there till the 8:30 meeting. I just sat on, instead of driving by and going, nobody's there. You know, and this is the first psychic change I really noticed. Instead of driving by and saying, oh, nobody's there, I'll come back, I drove by, and if nobody's there, I thought, well, I'll go sit on the porch, and maybe the next person who drives by will go, hey, Beth's there, and they'll stop. And then there'll be two. So. You know, I love what Tom Ivester says about, you know, somebody has to be first. And he talked about his heroes in AA weren't necessarily the first 100. That was the second wave who went up to Akron, got sober, and came back to where they lived and planted a flagpole and hung on for dear life until somebody else came, you know. And so I just went every day, and I went to this noon meeting, and then I would go to speaker meetings at night because I remembered I had no life. And so God's got this great sense of humor. I'm going to 2 meetings a day now, and I'm hearing a whole chapter of the book. This meeting was formatted. They read the preface and forewords the first day, the doctor's opinion the second day, chapters 1 through 11, and started over. So every 13 days, I heard the first 164 pages of that book. And for me, that was good. You know, I know there are book studies out there where they read 2 sentences and talk for an hour. I'm not making fun of it. I'm sure they serve a good and useful purpose too. But for me, you know, I needed to hear the book. I didn't need to hear people pontificating on what was in the book. I needed to hear the book. Because when I read the book myself, I was either 40 pages in, didn't know what I read, or I was staring at the same paragraph for half an hour, you know. And even in the meeting, I could barely keep up. I'd be reading like, you know, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed. I wonder what it's going to cost to get my car out of impound later. I better call that guy after the meeting, you know. And I'd hear somebody turn a page, and I would rejoin the crowd. And or I would, I know none of you guys did this, but I would, you know, we went around the room and read. We didn't, you know, just pop up and read. And so I would count, you know, around to see so I'd know which paragraph's mine. Because I want to be sure I know all the words. I don't want to look bad. And sometimes, I mean, there's endless possibilities. Like, you know, well, rarely have we seen a person fail. You know, rarely have we seen a person fail. You know, rarely have we seen a person fail, you know. Rarely have we seen a person fail. I mean, my God, you know. So I've counted, and I'm ready, and it's coming around the room, and it's almost my turn. And frickin' Kathy reads 2 paragraphs. There's always one. There's always one. But the biggest joke on me was that people who go to Big Book meetings on purpose tend to be the ones who read it and do what it says. And I had unwittingly plopped myself into the most active group of Cincinnati Alcoholics Anonymous people. And the other thing that happened was when I heard that book over and over and over, it started to sink in. And I was working for my mom because I was basically unemployable. I would go answer phones at her office for a couple hours, leave and go to the noon meeting, then go back. And I think I was about 3 weeks sober, and I was stopped in Walgreens on the way back to her office, and I popped up to see what everybody was talking about, because, I mean, they're always up there. I just don't check in with them very much anymore. But I stopped up to see what everybody was talking about. And somebody in my head was going, that was so cool what Guy said at the meeting. And somebody else was going, I know, I didn't even know that was in the book, did you? And somebody else was saying, I didn't know that was in the book either. And I just thought, oh, my God, the voices in my head are getting sober. You know, I mean, it's like... It's a good sign when they're up there discussing the meeting without you, you know? My sponsor said, appoint a sober chairperson and get out of there. So that's what I did. And, you know, as always, because I tend to bounce back and forth, I never have time to tell you a whole lot about what's going on today, other than that, you know, the children did come back to live with us. When I was a year sober, my mom and I talked and decided that no good purpose was served by them coming to live with me then, because at a year sober, they had been with her for 4 years. They were in a blue ribbon school district. They'd been in the same school. They had a clean, safe neighborhood, and I was in a 10th floor efficiency in a crappy part of town. And it didn't seem like any greater good was served by them coming down to my level. And we determined that I would catch up to them because they were, you know, I was the disruption. They weren't. They were doing what they were supposed to. And I know everybody doesn't have that choice. You know, not everybody's children are in a safe place. But, you know, if they are, well, I chose to agree with my mother. And they stayed with my mom. And I went back to school. And I, you know, I began to catch up to them. I saw this guy in AA. I was about a year and a half sober, and they had this all-group gratitude night on Monday where the suburban groups would come in and one of their speakers would speak. And I tended to view suburban discussion meetings as a little on the dry side. I was a speaker, Big Book meeting girl, you know, and I'm like, oh, great, Mount Washington night, whoopee, you know. But this guy came and gave a talk, and he was kind of cute, and he gave this great talk. I never forgot his name after he talked, and which is unusual for me. And And I tell him now, you know, that after that talk, I said to myself, you know, I want what he has, and I'm willing to go to any lengths to get it. That's not really what happened. We started crossing paths a little more often, and a year later we started hanging out. We didn't even say the D word because we didn't want to jinx anything, you know, and we made the decision to date with our clothes on. We had both done a lot of dating at Last Call, and we wanted to get to know each other, and so we fell in like first. We developed a relationship. We fell in like. We fell in love. We made a commitment to each other that God would always be first in our relationship, and then AA, and then each other. Because if God's not first, everything's out of kilter, you know, and I know I'm not qualified to be his higher power, so I certainly proved that this afternoon. And it's worked. July we'll be married 22 years. We moved to a neighborhood next to where the kids live because they were in a pricey neighborhood. So we were getting closer, you know, and they spent some time with us. They spent a lot of weekends with us. And I'll just tell a couple of quick stories because I know it's getting hot in here. At least it's hot up here. We were in the suburb next to theirs, and we got them bicycles for Christmas because, you know, they were getting to be that age. And of course, in Ohio, if you get a bicycle for Christmas, you can ride it in March or April. So when spring came, you know, we're out on the bicycles. We got bikes too because we thought we should probably ride with them. They were still pretty young. So we're out on our bicycles, you know, mom, dad, big brother, little sister on our bicycles. We're going down the street, and this guy's out mowing his grass because they do that a lot in the suburbs. They mow their grass, and he waved, you know, and they do that a lot in the suburbs too. So we waved, you know. Now where we've been living, it's usually two hands up. But they just wave out there, so we wave back. And about the time I waved, I got a look at where I was, and I thought, oh my God, I'm riding through the suburbs on a lavender Huffy. I used to own a Harley Davidson. How did this happen? But there's a guy in Greensboro named Bill Crawford, and he says, grace is that moment when we see things exactly as they are. And what I realized right then is there was nowhere I wanted to be except on that bike with those kids. And my biggest fear when I got sober was that I would be unable to love them. I didn't know if alcoholism had just killed off that ability in me. I didn't know if I'd be able to love them or not. And they came to meetings with me on weekends because they were invisible around me. My kids did 4 meetings a week the first 3 years I was sober. You know, from Friday to Sunday, we did. But you know what? You guys talked to them, and you called them by name, and you sat down in a chair so they could talk to you at eye level. They didn't have to look up, and you knew they played soccer. And you colored with Sarah, and you had them help you go get coffee cups, and you were interested in their lives, and their gaze came up off the floor, and they became less invisible. And I learned to talk to my kids watching you guys talk to my kids, you know, and you allowed them in meetings, and nobody, you know, sometimes they'd be, well, they're kids, you know, and so sometimes I would feel like half of the room was going, for God's sakes, do something about those children, and the other half is going, leave them alone, Beth, they're kids. You know, so it'd just be like, and somebody just said, you know, kids are just extensions of our egos. And I was like, oh yeah, that again. But you know what? If Sarah, when my kids was restless, somebody would take them outside and play with them so I could get a meeting. And that's what I try to do now. You know, I hope you never see me glare at a mom whose kid is making noise. You know, I hope you see me take that kid outside. Because, I mean, we don't bring them to meetings because it's fun. We bring them to meetings because we need a meeting. You know. So my kids grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous. They're 30 and 32 now. That doesn't seem possible. I have a granddaughter that's going to be 7 on 4th of July. That doesn't seem possible. I know you're just thinking I'm way too young to be a grandmother. you know, but all of these things because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I'm a licensed driver. I have a car, insurance, and a license all at once. All of my magazine subscriptions come in the same name. I vote. I'm a good neighbor. I'm a wife. I'm a good daughter. I'm a responsible pet owner. And I haven't killed a plant for 8 years. Two weeks ago, we were in the Outer Banks. Some friends had invited us to a house they rented. And I noticed the second day it was there that the name of this house was the Do Duck Inn. Like, you know, Do Stop Inn, Do Duck Inn. And I realized that the bar that I drank in, which is a lovely place, you know, at the end of my drinking was the Do Drop Inn. And I just thought, you know, I'm looking at this 6-bedroom house that has a pool out back in the Outer Banks with my sober friends, and the beach is a 3-minute walk at the Do Duck Inn. And I thought, how do you get here from the Do Drop Inn? Except for the grace of God, you know? I mean, this is where I found God. Because I worked the steps, not because I got to step 3 and found God. You know, step 12 says, as a result of these steps. So stick around, get a sponsor, work the steps, and wait for the miracle because, you know, this is God's perfect valet. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.